I want to invite you to get out your sermon notes. As Mark said, we're beginning a brand new series this morning on the life of Joseph. And really, what Mark said was true about those songs. They all fit in perfectly. And I was thinking maybe we should just like give the benediction and send you all home. And you'd be, no, you'd probably feel ripped off and shortchanged if I did that, wouldn't you? No? fishing for some compliments here, and I'm going to get myself in trouble. Let's pray together and just ask God to just be with us. Father, again, we just count it such a privilege. We've been able to worship you and just corporately together do that, declare that you are a great God. And we've just been reminded of some wonderful truths again. And Lord, I don't think there's a single one of us here who doesn't need to be reminded of those things on a regular basis. And so it's good to be able to do that. And to really just focus our attention on where it really needs to be focused. Because, Father, the truth is, through the week, sometimes our lives seem to kind of leak out. And we come together on Sunday mornings and we feel like it's been a while. And this gives us opportunity to recharge those batteries, to get excited again, to be reminded again of who you are and how you have worked in our lives. And for that, we're grateful. And now, Father, as we turn to your word, and we begin the life of Joseph together, story of a man who went from a pit to a palace. I pray, Lord, that you would just help us to take the lessons that we can draw out of it and apply them to our own lives, because I know, Father, there's going to be some valuable things that all of us can be taught through the life of Joseph. So continue to be with us, continue to guide us. Holy Spirit, we just invite you to continue to work in our hearts and our minds and in our lives. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. The following is a suicide note, and it was found beside the lifeless body of a young man in his mid-20s. Dear Mom and Dad, I'm sorry my life had to end this way. I'm sorry for the pain I've caused you in this act and all the other acts of my life. If you need an explanation or if you care to know, let me tell you why I decided to bring an end to my miserable life. See, I never fit in. There was no place for me on this planet. Though my siblings all seemed to find meaning and a place in life, I've always been an outsider. I've always, in the end, been rejected. Oh, don't get me wrong. I'm a great pretender. In fact, I'm the great pretender. For many years, I've pretended to be happy. But one tires of the sham sooner or later when there's nothing to go home to when it's over. Please don't think I haven't tried. I have. I've involved myself. I've played the game. I've gone from one thing to the next with some accomplishment. I've even cried out to God, but he's never answered me, or if he has, I haven't been able to understand. Life has turned the tables on me again and again. I don't want to continue when it doesn't make sense. Now I've decided it's enough. Though the act of my death may seem senseless to some, it makes sense to me. I no longer have to hurt. I no longer have to try. I no longer have to feel. I love you and I'm sorry, your son Joe. What a tragedy. What a tragedy that a young man with so much life still ahead of him could become so cynical that he felt he had no choice but to take his life. My question is this: how does a person get to a point of such despair? I mean, couldn't something have been done to rescue this young man from this sense of hopelessness that he was feeling? Didn't anyone see it coming? Is there anything in this life, then, that gives optimism in the face of these kinds of difficulties? Difficulties like misplacement and mistreatment and misunderstanding and rejection. Well, I believe there is. I believe that if this young man could have really known and understood his Creator, he could have seen that his life had meaning. As the late Corrie ten Boom, survivor of the Nazi concentration camps of World War II, once said, "There's no pit so deep that God isn't deeper still." There's no pit so deep that God isn't deeper still. That lesson is readily available in this book we call the Bible to anyone who is willing to seriously investigate it. And by its own claim, The Bible claims that everything we need for life and godliness is contained within it. But someone will say, well, if that's true, why don't more people use it? Why doesn't it help people like this Joe whose letter you just read to me? Well, the answer is that it does help people just like Joe every single day. Helps them avoid the pitfalls that lead to such confusion, despair, and cynicism. You don't always notice these people because they don't do things like prematurely ending their lives. Such people, because they know God and His Word, are confident that their lives have meaning. Their strong faith sustains them, and this confidence in God continues even in the face of adversity. They understand that by virtue of their membership in God's family, they're an important part of the grand scheme of cosmic significance, where everything that happens, good or bad, works together for their ultimate good. Well, as has been already been said, in the coming weeks, we're going to be looking at the story of a young man named Joe. Now, this isn't the same Joe who committed suicide, though if anyone had reason to despair, this Joe certainly did. You may know him better as Joseph. And his story is told in the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. The account of Joseph's life embodies some of the most significant truths in our Bibles. Although he was a human being just like you and me, Joseph blazed a new trail through a jungle of mistreatment, false accusation, undeserved punishment, and gross misunderstanding. And even if you've never considered something like suicide, if you've ever despaired because life just didn't make sense or it seemed like everything was against you and you wondered where God was in all of it, then Joseph's story is for you. You see, Joseph knew how to forgive. He shows us how to live a life free of bitterness. He manifested an unbelievably positive attitude towards those who hurt him. Most significantly, though, was the fact that he didn't waver in his trust of God. The story of Joseph begins in Genesis chapter 37 and ends in chapter 50, 13 chapters in all. But the truth is, Joseph's story actually begins with his father Jacob, the grandson of Abraham, the most famous character in the Old Testament history. And as we get into the main part of the message now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you points that are more like section headings as we work our way through the text for this morning. And we're going to begin with Genesis 37:1, and what we're going to find first of all is a description of a deeply troubled family. As I said, Joseph's story really began with his aging father Jacob. And if you look at Genesis 37, starting to read verse 1, it says, Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob. So Jacob, Joseph's father, who was also called Israel by God, is a colorful character in his own right. One commentator describes him like this, and listen to this. Intrigue and deception describe big chunks of his life, interrupted briefly by flashes of spirituality. Let me read that again. Intrigue and deception describe big chunks of his life, interrupted briefly by flashes of spirituality. And when I read that, I kind of, you know, looked at myself in the mirror and said, could that be said of you, John? Are there just flashes of spirituality in your life, or is that an ongoing thing, something that is evident all the time in your life? Well, if you'll bear with me through a few more details in Jacob's life, I'll show you what led up to the disturbing situation related to the life of Joseph. Jacob, in case you were wondering, was the one who had worked 7 years for Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, only to be deceived on their wedding night when Laban substituted his older daughter Leah. And then Jacob willingly worked another 7 years for Rachel's hand. But at the end of the day, he ended up with two wives instead of one. Now, in all honesty, I don't believe God ever intended for man to practice polygamy. Back in the garden, in Genesis 2:24, this is what he said. He said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and they will become one flesh. And notice the emphasis here on the word wife. He didn't say wives, plural. Now, it does seem, however, for some reason, that God allowed polygamy during the times of these patriarchs, though it's never without its accompanying problems. I honestly think that polygamy in Joseph's family could well be cited as the root cause of most of Joseph's problems. You see, there was a tremendous rivalry between the two wives of Jacob. And they fought and they argued. They competed for his attention. At times, they even bartered in order to decide who got to sleep with him. And then if that weren't enough, when Rachel had trouble conceiving, according to the local custom, she gave Jacob her maidservant Bilhah as a third wife to have children in her place. Well, Leah, her sister, not to be outdone, did the same with her maidservant Zilpah, and the race to produce offspring was on. And you can read all about that in Genesis chapter 30. But at the end of the day, the result was that Jacob ended up with four quarreling wives and all the ingredients for what we would label today a dysfunctional home. As you can well imagine, there was a population explosion in the Jacob residence as all four Mrs. Jacobs began to produce children. As a result, Jacob ended up with 12 sons, and we really don't know how many daughters, but you can be sure that there were quite a few of them as well. And I'm sure that must have generated some intense rivalry amongst the kids. As we pick up the story of Joseph's life, his father Jacob seems to fulfill the classic example of a passive, preoccupied father. One much too busy making a living and coping with the squabbles of four wives, and thus not have enough time or enough energy to deal effectively with the wrongs that occurred in the lives of his boys. Well, Joseph, we're told, was born late in Jacob's life during what would probably be the grandfather years in a normal monogamous home. We also learn that Joseph was just a young boy when tragedy struck his father. Rachel, Jacob's second and favorite wife, died while giving birth to her second son, Benjamin, and it really sent Jacob for a loop. And then the oldest son, Reuben, he became involved in an incestuous relationship with Bilhah, Jacob's third wife, and we read that in Genesis 35:22. And then added to that, Jacob received the news that his daughter Dinah had been abducted by the Shechemites and was raped. And you can read all about that in Genesis chapter 34. So in addition to the fact that Rachel had died, and the fact that she was Jacob's favorite wife, along with the impact of all these other events I just mentioned, all those things together may have had something to do with the close ties that began to develop between Jacob and the little boy Joseph. Maybe Jacob even felt a bit like life had outrun him, and that young Joseph presented him an opportunity to start over and to avoid the mistakes he'd made with his older boys. Whatever the reason, Joseph became Jacob's favorite son. Verses 2 and 3 of Genesis 37 tell us about Joseph's favorite position with his father. It says this: Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. So we see here that Joseph's family was in the shepherding business. We aren't told the nature of this bad report that Joseph brought back to his father. It may suggest that the brothers were involved in some kind of mischief. We really don't know. But what we do know for certain is that Joseph's half-brothers resented him and hated him with intensity. And him going to their father with this bad report didn't make the situation any better. Now, the bitterness of Joseph's brothers may have stemmed from one of several things. One may have been the indignation and the rivalry harbored by the four bickering mothers, which would have naturally spilled over into the kids in the home. Another reason for their dislike of Joseph becomes evident from a reading of verse 3. It says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he'd been born to him in his old age, and he made him a richly ornamented robe." You know, they say that a lot of men grow softer emotionally as they grow older. Well, Jacob, who was not much different, did something he had not done for any of his other sons. He made Joseph this richly ornamented robe. The King James Version of the Bible puts it this way. He made him a coat of many colors, something the term more of us are probably familiar with. Now, those of us, or those who studied the customs of that day, and I shouldn't include us being me in that, but those who studied the customs of that day tell us that robes like this were worn mostly by the children of royalty, and they were very expensive. And it may well have looked something like this. Now, with this special gift may have brought Jacob and Joseph much closer together. It certainly didn't help the relationship between Joseph and his older brothers. Verses 4 through 11 describes the jealous conflict that resulted. Look at verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So from that point on, whenever Joseph had contact with his brothers, it was on unfriendly terms. I mean, try to put yourself in that scenario. It must have been hard growing up with that kind of rejection. I mean, the norm is for big brothers to look out for their little brothers, right? And for little brothers to look up to their big brothers. But that wasn't the case. And more than that fact was the fact that he was their father's favorite son. And that was another reason for the resentment of the older brothers. And we see that in the next few verses. Look at verse 5. It said, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. You can imagine how they must have appreciated that revelation. Well, look at their response in verse 8. His brothers said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he'd said. So it was bad enough that their father favored him. But when he told them about his dream, it was almost more than they could handle. I honestly think that this dream was the straw that broke the camel's back. But he wasn't done yet. There was still more to come that made it even worse. Look at verse 9. Then he had another dream. Yeah, I think Joseph was pretty naive when it came to this. He must have missed, you know, how his brothers were reacting to this. But he had another dream and he told this to him. Listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. How many brothers did he have? 11, right? Well, this time, not only did the brothers get mad, Dad got mad too. The meaning was obvious to all of them. Look at verse 10. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what's this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? Verse 11 says, his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Joseph's dreams, as his continuing story will later verify, came from God. So in reality, he was suffering the disapproval of his brothers at this point for something that God had caused to happen in his life. Now, in a sense, that doesn't seem fair, does it? Our expectations so often require that things should always seem fair, especially where God is involved. And then when things aren't fair or don't seem fair from our vantage point, or God doesn't intervene to stop them, we have this tendency to call God's character into question. You know, doesn't he care about what's happening to me? If he's all powerful, then why doesn't he stop this from happening in my life? Is he really there for me? Does he even really exist? You know, it's possible that the Joe who wrote the suicide note I read earlier had asked some of these same questions before he concluded that God didn't care about him and that his situation was hopeless. It's possible that some of you here may have asked them too at some point in your lives. If so, you need to learn three very important truths about God. And the first is that God doesn't always intervene in our lives when things don't seem fair. We may not like that or understand that, but it's the truth. The second truth is that God doesn't always stop others from doing evil to us. Could he? Sure he could. He's God after all. And why doesn't he? Well, that's a question only God can answer. And the third truth is that God will always work these things out for our ultimate good in the long run if we continue to trust in him. We studied that in detail just a few weeks ago when we looked at Romans 8 together. But that's God's answer and solution to the questions raised by the first two truths. Though the brothers at this point were scoffing at the idea that these dreams came from God, and Jacob was rebuking him for suggesting that the rest of the family would ultimately bow down to him, what God was doing was playing out the opening scene in a drama that would be part of Joseph's life for the next 23 years. During those years, though, God was very busy leading and guiding in Joseph's life and working out a plan to bless Joseph beyond his wildest dreams based on some of the things that happened to Joseph in the process of getting there. It would not have been easily seen if you'd stopped anywhere along that timeline. From Joseph's perspective, it would have been easy to think that God and the whole world was against him. One of the great lessons to learn from the life of Joseph is that it's not always possible to understand what God is doing in your life right at the moment. In fact, it may seem that God is not even there at all. Sometimes, in fact, oftentimes, it takes time for his plans and his purposes to unfold for us. I mean, as I already said, it was 23 years into the future before Joseph would recall the occasion of these dreams along with all that had happened after them, and it would finally all make sense to him. 23 years. Genesis 50:20, probably the most significant single verse in the entire story of Joseph. He would say these words to his brothers who'd thrown themselves down before him in fear of their lives. He says this, he says, "For you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." So folks, don't despair if or when it seems like things are going against you. If you are striving to do what is right, if you're serving God with all you can be certain that God is there and that he's working everything out for your ultimate good, even though you may not always see the direct evidence of him doing that. Well, let's move on with the life of Joseph. We left off with his brothers being extremely jealous of him. I'm sure you've observed this before, maybe even in your own life, but it's that resentment will always work its way to the surface eventually if it isn't dealt with. In the case of these brothers, their resentment continued to grow until it developed into, and this brings us to our second point, a full-blown murder plot. It all began when Joseph was sent by his father to check up on his brothers. Their scheme unfolds in verse 12 and the verses that follow. Now, his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. Now, Shechem was about 50 miles away from the place where Jacob had set up his base camp. And it was that time of the year when they were having to range the animals further and further from home in order to find some fresh pasture. And it may have been some time since Jacob had heard from them, so he's getting a little bit worried, and so he decides to see how things were going for them. Well, let's continue with verse 13. "And Israel said to Joseph, 'As you know, your brothers are gazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them.' 'Very well,' he replied." I'm just going to pause here for a second, because I don't know about you, but as a parent, I really liked Joseph's quick and obedient response here. Right? His dad says, "I've got a job for you to do." And Joseph says, "No problem, on my way." You know, no hassle, right? No complaining, no whining. Imagine that. Now I know we're only getting a small glimpse of him here, but I have to think that Joseph's attitude as a young teen here at home had a lot to do with the extent that God could use him so greatly later on in his life. Now, let me just say this as an aside. If any of you teens want to be used by God for something great, if you want your faith to count for something of significance, I honestly think that you can determine it in many ways by how you act right now while you're young. Don't ever make the mistake of saying, you know, one of these days when I grow up, you know, one of these days when I reach adulthood, then I'll start to be obedient. You know, right now, because I'm young, it's my time to be, you know, wild and free and to have fun. You see, if you do that, the truth is that one of these days has a tendency of getting pushed off further and further into the distance. And you know what? Our world is full of people who are now 40 and 50 years old who are still saying, you know, one of these days I should get my act together. I don't know about you, but I that's just a sad reality to me. I think that if you're disobedient now, the odds are likely that you'll be the same way when you get older. Just an aside, but let's continue on with verse 14. So he said to them, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. And he sent them off from the valley of Hebron. Now, we find out that it turned out to be difficult for Joseph to locate the place where his brothers were camped, as we learn in the next few verses. Let's continue with verse 15. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? He replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks? They've moved on from here, the man answered. I heard him say, let's go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. Now, Joseph was probably relieved to find his brothers there and glad to see him. Little did he know that what they had in store for him would alter the course of his life forever. Well, it turns out that they recognized him from a distance. I'm guessing that this coat of many colors stuck out like a sore thumb, you know, on the plain browns of the desert. And quickly they formed their deadly plan. Look at verse 18. It says, but when they saw them him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him. Throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dream. So Joseph finds the brothers in Dothan. The word literally means two wells. And verse 20 says they're going to throw him into one of those wells. Verse 24 says that it was dry, there was no water in it. It's possible they had come to two wells in search of water for their flocks, only to find them both dry, as is mentioned here. And I'm sure if that's the case, it would have, you know, wouldn't have helped their already somewhat ugly dispositions. Now, fortunately for Joseph, his brother Reuben comes to his rescue. Look at verse 21. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. And then it says, Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take them back to his father. Now, one of the things that we are going to see a lot of through the life of Joseph is God's providence at work. And folks, here's the truth about God's providence. Nothing, whether it is good or evil, can stand in the way of it. As we continue in this study, you're going to see me pointing it out at every opportunity as we study the life of Joseph. It's one of the choice lessons of Joseph's life. And my first opportunity to point it out is right here. You know, when you first read verse 22, it actually sounds like Reuben is really, you know, concerned for his little brother. Now you're probably inclined to think that maybe, just maybe, he wasn't infected by the bitterness of his other brothers. But I wouldn't conclude that too quickly if I was you. Let me tell you why I think that. We know that Reuben was the oldest in the family, which means he was in line for the birthright and inheritance of his father. Now, among other things, that meant that he would inherit twice as much as his other brothers would be given. Now, under normal conditions, that would have been beyond challenge. But if you remember in the beginning of the message, I mentioned Reuben's incestuous involvement with Bilhah, one of his father's wives. All that to say that I think it was entirely possible that Reuben's birthright may well have been in jeopardy at this time due to his sin with Bilhah. Now, I want to suggest to you that he, like the other brothers, probably would have cheerfully murdered Joseph, but I think he had a vested interest. You see, if his father found out that he is the oldest, had been involved in Joseph's death, or had done nothing to prevent it, it would have definitely finished him off as an heir for certain. But on the other hand, If he could thwart the plans to kill Joseph and then deliver him back to his father with the story of the other brother's intention of killing him, he would look like the hero and maybe be restored back to the front line as far as his inheritance was concerned. Now that, of course, is all speculation on my part. But based on what we've seen of him in the past, it's very possible that that was what he was thinking. So here's young Joseph, you know, in the midst of all kinds of evil intentions. There are 10 brothers who had every intention of wanting to kill him and then cover it up. I mean, there's definitely some evil intent there. And then there's this other brother who may well be selfishly fixed on avoiding being cut out of his father's will. Again, more evil intent. Now the odds of this somehow turning into anything good for Joseph doesn't seem very likely, does it? So how is God going to rescue Joseph from all of this evil intent? Well, no problem. As I said earlier, God is never limited by the evil intentions of men. He has the ability to bring good results out of all kinds of evil circumstances. That's what's meant by providence. Well, let's see how it happens. As I said, they're 50 miles from home. Everyone in the group has selfish motives. There's no one else to save Joseph. I mean, no one would have ever known if these guys had murdered their brother. And it looks like certain doom for Joseph. And then suddenly one of the hateful brothers steps forward to save him. Now, at a surface reading, that could have easily been written off as a coincidence. But because we know how the story ends, it's obvious to us that it is a case of God's providence, of God working all things, good and bad, together for Joseph's good. But even more than that, God working all things together for the ultimate good of this little family clan that would ultimately become a great nation, and ultimately, you know, the Messiah would come out of that family. No, God was not responsible for the incest of Reuben with Bilhah. Neither was God responsible for the festering hatred of these brothers. But God, in his providence, could certainly use the two events, one against the other, to spare Joseph's life and to propel him forward into the next stage of his plan. And that's exactly what he did. God was taking care of Joseph, certainly with the future of the nation of Israel also in mind, though Joseph himself had no idea that God was at work in any of this at this time. God's promise to us, and we know this one, his promise to us in Romans 8:28, one of those benefits I mentioned we had when we looked at this a few weeks ago, is that in all things he works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose. You know, I think one of the problems that we typically have with this verse is related to our impatience. You know, we want good things to happen, and we want them to happen now. But that's not how God usually works. So don't think that just because you don't see it or recognize it happening immediately that this verse isn't true. This verse is God's promise to us, and it is valid whether we see it or not. And our part is to trust in his timing. Now this is just an aside, but have you ever wondered, and I've thought of this often, but have you ever wondered how many other Josephs or Abraham's, or David's, or Isaiah's, or Apostle Paul's, or Billy Graham's there might have been, but that we've never heard of, because they bailed on God before he could fully prepare them for what he had in mind for them. Well, God was taking care of Joseph through this ordeal, and he was working out his greater plan to do good for Joseph at a later date, while at the same time, keeping the future of his chosen people Israel secure. But as for Joseph, time and time again, we'll see him get delivered by circumstances that look on the surface to be coincidental, but they happen too often to be accounted for that way. I want to invite you to watch as we progress through Joseph's life, so that whenever you see it, you can take it as a reassurance that God is there in your life as well. Let's continue with verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing. They took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. As they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Now get ready for some more of God's providence here, because it's going to come again, though it's going to be a bit disguised at first. Now, this one actually brings us to the third point, where we see next a cruel trade. A cruel trade. As the brothers sat there eating, with Joseph likely pleading for his life from the bottom of the pit, they began to hear the creaking of wagon wheels and camel's hooves on the desert floor. It tells us that they look and they see a caravan of Ishmaelite traders coming their way. Well, look at the second part of verse 25, where it says, of these Ishmaelites, that their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Now, Ishmaelites were basically traveling nomads, much like the gypsies of the last century or so. They made their living buying and selling whatever they could find to make a profit. And as we read this, caravan was on its way to Egypt, and as it approached, Judah, one of the brothers, got a bright idea. Look at verse 26. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his sin? Come and cover up his blood, pardon me. Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hand on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. Now it's amazing to me how pious some people can sound, even though they're doing wrong. I mean, just a few moments ago, Judah was all for Joseph's murder. But now he realizes the possibility of some extra cash in his pocket. And he says, after all, he's our brother. Now, I don't think Judah received any special reward for avoiding murdering his brother. This suggestion would still enable them to get rid of Joseph while at the same time being profitable for both him and his brother. So no brownie points are awarded to him for this one. So they threw Joseph a rope. And verse 28 says, so when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern, sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who then took him to Egypt. Now, 20 shekels of silver was the going price for a young slave in those days. So there he goes. Joseph, the 17-year-old favored son of his father Jacob. The young teenage boy who would later show the world what trust in God is all about. He certainly doesn't look like much of a hero at this point, does he? And neither does he look like a prime example of how God takes care of his own. I mean, there he goes, hitched to the back of a wagon with a chain around his neck and shackles on his wrists, on his way to who knows where to do who knows what. Do you suppose he might have asked himself something like, "Where are you, God? Why have you let this happen to me? What did I do to deserve this? Is this what I get for obeying my father and being concerned for my brothers? Why, God? Why is this happening? It's just not fair." Now, for any of us who've been asking some of those same kinds of questions, you need to know, as I said earlier, Joseph didn't get the full answer to his questions for another 23 years. Folks, that is a long time to be left wondering. It's a long time to keep on trusting. It's a long time to keep hoping. If truth be told, I'm sure that many of us would admit that we usually give up after a few days or at the very most a few weeks, but not Joseph. And when the answer comes, though, it's an amazing story, as we'll see in the coming weeks. Well, apparently Reuben had left at some point because he persuaded the brothers to spare Joseph. And we find in verse 29, he's coming back from somewhere. It says, when Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. Now, for those of you who thought that maybe I had misjudged Reuben, look at these next verses, verse 30, where it says of Reuben, he went back to the brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now?" Now, notice what he was concerned for here. He says, "Where can I turn now?" I think he was convinced that losing Joseph, his father's favorite son, would be the last straw as far as him losing his inheritance. But no problem, the brothers say to him. We've got it all figured out. Look at verse 31. Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in the blood, They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." And he recognized it and said, "It's my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." And verse 34 says, "Then Jacob tore his robes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days." Let me just backtrack just for a moment. Jacob had lost his favorite wife. He'd worked 14 years for her hand in marriage. He'd suffered humiliation with his daughter Dinah, not to mention Reuben's incest. And now Rachel's firstborn son, his favorite son, was reported dead. Now, if we didn't skip ahead in the story, we wouldn't know this, but when we come to Genesis 44, we discover that it was almost more than he could bear. I mean, what incredible deception existed in this family. But what happens in the next verse really takes the cake, in my opinion. Look at verse 35. It says, "All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, he said, in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son. So his father wept for him." I don't know about you, but I find that incredibly hypocritical that these deceivers now become the comforters. I actually find it quite sickening. What about Joseph? What became of him? Look at verse 36. "Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard." Well, folks, my time is gone this morning, but I do want to close just with a short story about God's protection and his providence. It's a story of a man by the name of Frederick Nolan. And Frederick Nolan, as the story goes, was fleeing from his enemies during a time of persecution in North Africa. One night he fell exhausted into a wayside cave, fully expecting that his pursuers would find him very soon. Resigned to face his death with dignity, he noticed that there was a spider weaving a web over the opening of the cave. And he said that within what only seemed like minutes, the little arachnid had woven a beautiful lacework across the entire mouth of the cave. Well, as it turns out, when the pursuers arrived at the opening of that cave, they wondered out loud if Nolan might be hiding inside, but then they saw the unbroken spider's web and decided it would have been impossible for him to enter into that cave without having broken the web. And so they went on, and Nolan escaped. Later he wrote these words, and this is what I love. He says, "Where God is, a spider's web is like a wall. Where God is not, a wall is like a spider's web." I'll leave you with this. Don't ever think that just because God's presence in your life seems at the moment no more significant than a spider's web, that he has deserted you. His promise, as I've repeated through this entire message several times, to all of us who love him, is that he will cause good to come into our lives if we continue to trust him. Amen? Would you pray with me? Father, there is so much for us to learn from the life of Joseph. I think the most significant truth is us being able to witness his continued trust in you in spite of these incredibly difficult circumstances. Father, I think that there's not a single one of us here. If we had to have gone through what Joseph had gone through, I'm positive our trust and our confidence in you would have wavered many times over. In fact, I would venture to say that some of us maybe would have bailed on you long ago. Joseph, Lord, sets an example for us of what it means to keep on hoping, to keep on trusting. And Lord, I know that we have some in our congregation who've gone through much in their lives. They've experienced a lot of difficulty physically, health-wise, emotionally, through relationships. And Lord, my prayer is for them that they wouldn't be discouraged by these things. They would realize just by hearing about the life of Joseph how it took 23 years for him to finally put it all together, what you were doing in his life and why you were doing it, that just like Joseph, we would continue to trust you in spite of not having the answers in the here and now, knowing again that you love us, you care for us, and you're working out all things together for our good. And ultimately, Lord, it's all part of your plan and your purpose because you're a sovereign God. So I pray, Father, for anyone here who might feel that discouragement or might be worried or might be thinking, God's given up on me, so I'm going to give up on him. I pray that they would be encouraged to come close to you once again and to keep on trusting you. Lord, I ask all of that in Jesus' name. Amen.